This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. How are working families doing in the current economy? That's the subject of the new edition of the biannual report, The State of Working America, a project of the think tank, the Economic Policy Institute. Later this month, Cornell University Press will publish the report in book form. My guest, Jared Bernstein, is a co-author of the report. He's a labor economist who joined the Economic Policy Institute in 1992 and took a leave to serve as deputy chief economist at the Labor Department in 95 and 96 under President Clinton. The Economic Policy Institute, which was established in 1986, describes its goal as broadening the discussion about economic policy to include the interests of low- and middle-income workers. Bernstein says that the U.S. economy is in recovery, but the benefits are not reaching workers and families. This has been referred to as a jobless recovery. Would you still describe it that way?
Not at all, in fact. I think one of the more positive aspects of the recent recovery is that starting last fall, we began adding employment month by month. I don't think we've had a negative month for over a year. The problem is that the job growth has been a bit too tepid. Too often when we look at this question of whether jobs are growing or not, we're simply asking, are we adding jobs or losing jobs? That's too weak a criterion to evaluate the strength of the labor market. We need to not only add jobs, we need to add at least 150 to 200,000 per month. And unfortunately, months like that have been the exception to the rule.
Why do we need to add 150,000 to 200,000 jobs a month?
We need to add that many jobs per month in order to absorb all those people coming into the job market looking for work, as well as rehiring the millions who were laid off over the course of the recession and the jobless recovery. If we don't add that many jobs, the unemployment rate won't fall very much. And in fact, it's, I think, telling that the unemployment rate was 5.6% when this recovery began in November of 2001. And most recently, it's been around 5.4%, 5.5%. So we've actually made very little progress in terms of lowering unemployment, even while we're adding jobs.
So you're saying that we're really no longer in a jobless recovery. Jobs are being created. Is there any pattern you see in the types of jobs that are being created?
In fact, I'd say the patterns are evolving. When the jobless recovery ended in the fall of 2003, we started adding employment. We had a job quality problem. And in fact, you think back to the election, you heard candidate Kerry talking about how the new jobs paid so much less than the old ones. And he was talking about a problem in the quality of the jobs that we were creating. And in fact, on average, industries that were adding jobs paid considerably less than industries that were shedding jobs or growing more slowly. Things have improved a bit, and so I think that the quality of jobs we're adding now, by many dimensions, are okay. But one area where we still have a problem has to do with health care and pensions. Jobs that are being created now are far less likely to come with a more broad compensation package, including a decent health care program or a pension program. And in that sense, those jobs are of poorer quality.
Now, is this happening across the board, or is it, you know, only specific types of jobs?
You know, it's not happening across the board in the following sense. Those at the very top of the income scale have been doing far better than the rest. If you look at the trends in profits and compensation, you will see a very unique and unbalanced characteristic of the current economy. The rates of profit have really soared while compensation has been pretty flat. So while the economy has been growing, going back to our earlier discussion, there is an ongoing recovery underway. While the economy has been growing, most of the benefits have been flowing upward. So how you've done really is largely a function of where you are in that income or wealth scale.
What do you mean the benefits have been flowing upward? Can you give us an example of what you mean?
Sure. Historically, at this stage in a recovery, most of the growth of the economy is flowing into compensation. Say about 70% of the growth goes to wages and compensation, and about 30% goes into profits. Well, this time it's topsy-turvy. About 70% of the growth has gone to profits and only about 30% into compensation.
Is there any explanation for the trend that you've just described, where more money proportionately is getting put into profits than into wages?
I think the explanation really lies with the job market. Really at the heart of this analysis is the notion that our labor market serves as a mechanism to distribute the economy's growth. The economy has been growing quarter after quarter, year after year, but unless the unemployment rate is far lower than it is today, unless we're creating many more jobs than we've been creating, unless we're really hammering away at that jobs deficit, we can't expect the benefits of growth to be broadly shared. They tend to flow upward. It really is almost as simple as an employer who's facing a very tight labor market has to raise wages and compensation to get and keep the workers that they need. On the other hand, when the line of labor supply is forming outside the shop or the factory and there's lots of people seeking work, that is, there are more job seekers than there are job slots, that tends to put downward pressure on wage growth for many workers, and it leads to higher levels of inequality. This is, I think, the result that we're seeing really played out in today's economy.
Outsourcing is a word that Americans are becoming increasingly familiar with, and a lot of jobs that used to be done by workers here are now being done by workers in Bangalore, India, or other parts of the world. Have you crunched the numbers for outsourcing? And if so, what do they have to tell us?
Well, I've certainly reviewed all those numbers, and interestingly, they don't have a whole lot to tell us because it's very hard to know how many jobs have been outsourced or offshored. But let me say what I think we do know about it. First of all, for decades, we've been outsourcing employment in our manufacturing sector, and that's really led to the loss of millions of manufacturing jobs in this country. I think what's caught people's attention in recent years is that that phenomenon has crept up the scale, as it were. It's no longer affecting solely blue-collar workers. It's now affecting white-collar workers as well, and that's certainly a different trend and one that I think many have found alarming.
You know, a question you've raised is this. You know, a lot of people say, well, what workers really need now is better education and job retraining so that workers who have lost jobs can find new jobs and be trained appropriately for those new jobs. And you question whether that's really the issue right now.
I do and I don't. I mean, I certainly the idea of any individual seeking a higher level of skill or retraining makes sense for that person. However, there's a way in which this conversation, I think, gets very skewed, especially in the context of offshoring. You hear many economists talk about we simply need to reskill in order to be more competitive. But the people that they're talking about are some of the most skilled in the world. So, for example, if you talk about radiology, the idea that because we can now offshore these digital photos, x-rays and the like, hospitals can use radiologists in India and China, whereas before they didn't have that option. And that, of course, dampens the employment opportunities, the compensation of radiologists here. So, you know, the typical economist might say, well, that radiologist needs to become a pediatrician. That's a job that obviously can't be offshored so quickly. But the idea of retraining a radiologist to become a different type of a doctor raises this notion of training, raises the bar to a level we've never contemplated in our country. I mean, the training that we've done has always been on the low end, trying to provide the skills that, say, you know, high school dropouts need to make their way into the job market. So there's a kind of hand-waving that goes on, I think, when we talk about skill training that doesn't really deal with the realities of the offshoring challenge.
You know, because so much manufacturing and so many services have been outsourced to other countries where labor is cheaper, it means that some of the things we buy and some of the services we use are cheaper here. So does the average worker lose or gain in the long run, do you think? You know, on the one hand, you stand to lose your job. On the other mm-hmm. hand, the stuff you're buying is cheaper. It's like, can you figure out how that balances out?
Well, you're absolutely right to raise the plus side of the ledger, which is that thanks to all this globalization, prices certainly are rising less quickly than they have historically. And probably the best way to measure out the costs and benefits of that is to actually look at inflation-adjusted growth of income and wages, because that takes into account these price changes. And if you look since, say, the year 2000, you'll see that the typical family is actually about $1,500 worse off in real terms. That's about a 3% decline in their income. If you look at the low-income family, they're 6% worse off. So their losses have been twice as great. So even taking into account slower price growth, incomes for many of these families has grown more slowly. Now, part of that is because we've been through a recession, jobless recovery, but here we are 3 years into an economic recovery that, according to many commentators, has been pretty robust, yet many families are behind where they were just a few years ago. The reason why incomes have grown much less quickly at the bottom has to do with this notion of inequality, the idea that the growth in the economy has been funneled much more to those at the top than those at the bottom. There are a set of factors that have determined that result. We talked about the weak job market as one of them, but other factors include a decline in the minimum wage, less union power, more globalization. All of those factors have led to that outcome.
Now, you mentioned the decline in the power of unions as being one of the reasons why a lot of workers haven't kept up with the cost of living. Is there a way of measuring how much the power of unions has declined and what the percentages of workers who were unionized compared to 10, 20, 30 years ago?
Well, right now, about 9% of the private sector workforce is unionized. It's closer to 14 or 15 in the total workforce because the public sector has about a third a unionization rate. But if you look at the private sector job market, it's about 8 or 9%. And if you go back to the heyday of unions, it was probably closer to 30 or 40%, something in that range. Now, part of that has to do with the loss of manufacturing jobs. I mean, manufacturing is a sector that's historically been highly unionized, and we've lost millions of manufacturing jobs over the past a few decades. So that by itself has diminished union power. Now, unions have tried to make inroads into the services, and have actually done pretty well. The service employee unions, I believe, is one of the fastest growing unions. But certainly, union power has diminished over the past few decades, and that's helped lead to these increased inequality results that I've been describing. I would say one of the main factors that determines the distribution of the economy's growth and thereby explaining why that distribution has been so unequal in the past few years has to do with the bargaining power of the workforce. Economists are typically taught that each worker is paid commensurate to their skills and to their productivity. So if you're creating a certain amount of wealth or value, that's what you're going to get in your wage. But in the real world, I would say an equally important determinant of how much you end up getting paid is the kind of bargaining power you might have. That may have to do with whether you're male or female, whether you're a minority or a white worker, whether you're at the top end of the management scale or at the bottom. It has to do with factors, whether you're in a union, whether you're in a state with a higher minimum wage, et cetera. All of these bargaining power factors play a role, and they've been diminished for many in this workforce really over the past few decades. And that's one of the reasons why we've seen inequality on the rise.
Let's take a look at Social Security. The Bush administration says that we have a $10 trillion shortfall in Social Security and that this is threatening the entire system and causing a crisis, and that the cost of doing nothing to reform the system would be greater than the cost of acting now to change it. The way you crunch the numbers, does that conclusion fit with your analysis?
Well, not only does it not fit with my analysis, it doesn't fit with the analysis of the Social Security actuaries themselves, which may not be the most exciting group of people to raise on a radio show, but these actuaries have said that that kind of an estimate, that $10 trillion, I think they use the word, and I quote, misleading. Because that $10 trillion deficit is the deficit in Social Security over an infinite horizon. If you took any branch of government, any program, if you looked at the military, if you looked at social spending, you'd find deficits that were equally large, if not larger. So it's really a meaningless number. Social Security is not in crisis. There is a problem with funding the program, and historically such problems have evolved in the past, and we fixed them with fairly minor tweaks. This one could be fixed similarly.
What effect on different income brackets do you think privatizing Social Security would have?
Well, that's an important question because so much of our conversation has focused on this notion of economic inequality. One of the things that many of us like best about Social Security, and I guess you could say many of the privatizers like least, is the fact that it's actually a pretty progressive program. Those at the lower end of the income scale do better with Social Security than those at the higher end. If you privatize the system, it almost assuredly you would really kill that progressive component and end up with a program that would reinforce inequalities. I mean, think for a second, who would do better in a program where you manage your own stock portfolio? Those at the top of the income scale who have the time and the knowledge, or at least can hire the people with the time and the knowledge to do that, or those at the bottom who typically don't have experience, know how to necessarily manage stock portfolios, or B, have the savings that they can really put into it, even with this diverting their payroll taxes into private accounts.
President Bush has already cut trillions of dollars worth of taxes and proposes to cut a few trillion more. And he says the cuts are helping the economy. How do you measure if the tax cuts are helping workers?
One of the best ways to measure whether the tax cuts are helping workers is to actually hold the Bush administration accountable for their claims regarding these tax cuts in terms of job growth. When the administration introduced their tax cuts, they argued that these tax cuts would create something like 300,000 jobs per month from the middle of 2003 through the end of 2004. Well, in fact, they've had 1 or 2 months with job growth of that magnitude. So in terms of job growth, the tax cuts have clearly been a failure. In terms of economic growth, I think they have helped boost the rate of growth in the economy. GDP would have grown more slowly in the absence of these tax cuts. But while these tax cuts have helped generate faster economic growth, the fact that they've never achieved the job or wage or income growth that they were advertised has meant that they really haven't delivered the goods to working families. Furthermore, if you look at who did benefit from the tax cuts, of course, it's been widely documented that the benefits flowed to once again to those at the top of the scale. The top 1% ended up with something in the $80,000 range in terms of their lowered tax liabilities from these cuts. Those in the middle maybe got about $1,000. Those at the low end got about $100.
When you're thinking about the long-term impact of the tax cuts, do you take into account the possibility that perhaps we haven't given enough time to see what the long-term beneficial effects of the tax cuts will be, that it's maybe just too soon to tell, and that more benefits will appear in the future?
Well, possibly, but I don't think so. I mean, the tax cuts actually did help the economy grow more quickly, and that's you could see that already in some of the numbers from the period when they were implemented. The long-term effect from the tax cuts was advertised to be greater investment. This is supply-side economics. If you cut the taxes of those at the top of the income scale, they will invest more, and this will lead ultimately to faster productivity growth. Well, the investment results certainly don't show that to be the case, and there's no reason why that shouldn't show up in the short term. And in fact, interestingly, productivity growth was growing quicker before the tax cuts than it has been since. So really, I think the long-term effect of these tax cuts will simply be a more unequal post-tax income distribution. That's an effect that I think we will see in the long term. I don't think anyone could seriously argue that there'll be growth enhancing in the long term. And by the way, the Congressional Budget Office has analyzed just that and came to the same conclusion.
There's always been differences in how economists analyze and interpret the economy. But I'm wondering if you think those differences have widened as America seems to have become more divided politically.
Mm-hmm. I think they have widened. I think if you look back at the last, 4 years of the Bush administration, but you could even find this in 8 years of Clintonomics, there's been a prevailing view that free markets always yield the best result. I would say, the difference between, say, Clintonomics and Bushonomics is not so much the support for free market economy, which is really very robust in both cases, but in the Clinton case, it says, let the economy do its thing, and we'll redistribute a bit to help the losers. And in the Bush case, it's let the economy do its thing, and whatever happens, so be it. Really, if you go back to another era of economic thinking, say that much more associated with older democratic politics or Roosevelt economics, this was a view that said market outcomes are not always the best outcomes, and that there are ways to intervene in market outcomes to ensure that we have the economy that we want and the distribution of income that is fair and equitable. And so it doesn't necessarily accept the notion that the free market left alone is always the best way to run things. I think that has been really too widely accepted over the past few decades.
Well, Jared Bernstein, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jared Bernstein is senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute. He co-authored the Institute's new report, The State of Working America, 2004 to 2005. It's about to be published in book form by Cornell University Press.